Hey, folks.
What's up, man?
Just getting annoyed, refreshing myself on some of the subject matter that we're about to talk about.
Yeah, it's not fun, is it?
No, it's not fun. Maybe we should do it something.
Yeah, let's warm up a little bit before we get there, if that sounds good to you.
Yeah. I mean, one thing we got, Brandon, Let's Go Brandon content, things we don't like Joe Biden for, don't appreciate it for. Asal Rod was on our show recently. Patrons, you will know this. You'll have got the Sunday show where we talk about the failure of Biden to resume the Iran deal policy of his predecessor, which is one of the best things you could say about Barack Obama was the Iran deal. Mm-hmm. Instead follow Trump's lead. And this is a review with Israeli TV, because of course. That says Biden is committed to keeping the Iranian IRGC on the foreign terrorist organizations list, even if it kills the deal. And he's also willing to use force as a last resort. So here's Joe Biden on Israeli television.
Are you committed to keep the IRGC on the foreign terrorist organization list, even if that means that kills the deal?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You, in the past, said you'll do anything, and you say it again, that you'll ensure Iran would not acquire nuclear weapons. Does that also mean, sir, that you would use force against Iran? Is that what that means?
If needed? That was the last resort, yes. Mm-hmm.
And would you work in Israel with that kind of thing? Have you received any assurances from Israel?
I'm not going to speculate on that. Yeah. But Iran cannot get a nuclear weapon.
Are you committed to keep the IRG?
So, you know, he is, this is the direction he's decided. It's, you know, at the point we were talking with Asal, it was maybe, you know, they can do something on this. It seems like he's just capitulated. And this is a time where I just saw John Nichols tweet out the Libertarian Party, I believe calling on Joe Biden to remove forces and in cooperation with the bombings in Yemen. And they're right. Libertarians are right there. I mean, of course, they're not the only one saying that. And that's not the best brand of anti-war. But it's just saying, like, this is a complete capitulation of Biden to the neocon war hawks, basically. John Bolton is getting what he wants with this.
No, I mean, it's a continuation of one of the most damaging parts of Trump policy that, like, really puts the potential of some kind of hot conflict, which would be absolutely devastating for not only Iranian people, but also for America. I mean, like, it's just worth re-upping this, that, like, Iran is not Iraq or Afghanistan. You know, it's a country that has been, you know, strangled for a long time by American policy. But it is just not the same kind of scenario there. Like, if you thought those were terrible decisions, just militarily, this is just a very, very different situation. And this game of chicken that they're playing is extremely dangerous, especially when you remember that this isn't really achieving anything. Like, what is this truly achieving? It's just like Biden doesn't want to be called soft by Republicans in the upcoming primary. That's literally what this is. And it's cynical and it's evil and it's causing a lot of pain for a lot of people who I love, by the way. It's truly, truly wicked. Because again, Biden has no real attachment to this IRGC terrorist designation, but he's doing it anyway. And
he's a ghost ship. I mean, he's on autopilot and just whatever, and it's autopilot that's been set even before Obama, right? Mm-hmm. Like, just like all capitulation on all this shit. It's and the only thing it really serves is that it makes what would be an absolutely catastrophic invasion or war with Iran more possible. And, you know, in the meantime, you know, sell a bunch of military contracts for preparedness for such an eventuality. Like, it's a very sick world that we live in. And I do think, like, at the overly cynical reduction, which is like, of course this is happening. Obama fucking broke that with this limited area, and it was really great. And it sucks that it's gone. And, you know, I mean, it'd be nice if he'd say something, but about the one thing that the progressive left gives him credit for still. I'm not sure what he has said.
It's true that, like, there is something you'd think that Obama, being as much of a narcissist as he is, would want Biden to fix this, but
maybe Israel's like, we'll nuke you. Hey, I mean, you know, the
only country in the Middle East who has nuclear weapons.
Exactly. Illegally, that can precipitate a war.
And, you know, they don't admit that they have them, but they have them.
You know, that's the thing. If we want to accept this conversation where we don't want nuclear weapons in the Middle East, the focus should be on fucking Israel. Let's denuclearize Israel. You gotta get rid of them. That's contingent. Or the deterrence strategy, maybe I'm going to get my Kissinger on and be all of a sudden like pro nuclear weapons because of deterrence and stuff like that. I'm getting my Rand hat on, or we get rid of these. Like we all agree that we should. I mean, of course it should just be Israel, America and Russia and everybody that fucking has them should. It's insane that we spend so much money on these things, but yeah.
So we're going to get to the Nomigi stuff in a second, but just real quick, reminded folks, you can leave us a message at 1-940-289-7234. We've got two more quick things to get to before we go there. One is just re-upping something. I've tweeted this out, but I wanted to remind folks about a pretty egregious chapter here in Austin, where Alamo Drafthouse of Workers. So that used to be like, I remember going there a lot as a kid. It's now become somewhat of a national brand, but the South Lamar location, which is a very popular and busy one, the workers have been faced with really brutal conditions from management, understaffing during COVID. At the height of COVID, Texas opened up very early and they weren't protecting people. They have been organizing for a union there. They actually held a walkout last week. And asked people not to show up that day. And Alamo Drafthouse has fired one of the worker organizers there, Simon Ingram. Just really brutal, brutal stuff. Again, for attacking somebody for engaging in their constitutional right to seek union representation. So this is a change.org petition. You can find, I'll re-up it on my Twitter after the show. It's worth it if people can get in there and sign, especially if you are in the Austin area. But this is a national company now. I know they have locations in New York, in Virginia, DC area, and other places. It used to be a smaller company, and the founder, you know, they got bought out by big capital, which I will say has led to a serious decline in the food and beer there. But not the crime here.
I've been to the one in Brooklyn, and it's like the first of all. Luxury movie experience in terms of like the seating and things like that. And the people that provide that experience should absolutely have protection of a union.
I think that's well said. So yeah, try to see if you can get, if you can sign that and share that, especially if you are in the Austin, Texas area. But again, everybody feel free to jump in on that.
We're seeing a lot of retaliation. Starbucks closing locations because of crime. The same thing that fucking Walgreens was doing, when really it's they're closing unionizing mm-hmm. locations and using crime as really despicable, honestly, the way that corporations are weaponizing, basically the fruits of their fucking, well, not labor, I don't want to say, the fruits of their ownership and deprivation to rise in certain types of crime to blame it. I guess we got to fire our union workers. Despicable. But also shout out PBS NewsHour workers, unionized recently.
Oh, yeah.
And PBS NewsHour said to the media that they are going to voluntarily recognize union. They haven't told the union that yet. So, but anyway, good news there.
Hell yeah. Well, let's do one more Biden story before we get to this New York bit.
All right, cool.
Yeah. Because this is, I mean, I just love this because, you know, we've been talking a lot about AMLO on this program because he's president of a very important country, a country which, by the way, people should read Kurt Hackbar's piece, is now facing a very severe water shortage. But as Kurt notes in the piece and one of the popular protest slogans around this is that it's not drought, it's plunder. It's a country that is actually one of the wealthiest countries in the world when it comes to water. And the crisis in people, particularly in the center of the country, not having access to water is not because there's not enough water to go around. It's because it's getting bottled up and sent into the United States, either as water directly or in the form of beer or something like that. You know, huge American and global corporations are in there pillaging the country. But, you know, AMLO has taken a pretty strong stance against, you know, egregious American imperialism. As we noted, both with Danny Bessner and with Kurt Hackbarth, the Summit of the Americas was a great example of somebody, you know, sort of standing up and showing up. But one of the things that people noted was that, well, he was going to go and meet with Joe Biden. And the question was like, what was that meeting going to be like? What's happened now? So we can talk about it. And I'll start on Twitter and then we'll get to a little bit of the text of this meeting. This is from Ellie Stokels, Eli Stokels, I guess. Extraordinarily, AMLO has been speaking for 25 minutes in the Oval Office, offering Biden a lengthy soliloquy about the New Deal, gas prices, and opportunities for greater economic
climate,
which I think is a great a great use of almost time there, and reminding Biden that if he wants to have that big portrait up there and talk about this fella, he should be a little bit more inspired by the actual history of that president.
Absolutely. That is great. I love that. Lecture this old coot.
But let's get into some of the actual text of this. This is Yahoo News, but it comes from the Los Angeles Times. And of course, we're not going to do we're not going to come back at them for the anti-AMLO language, but of course you're getting a sense of it. You know, AMLO is just like a, you know, loves being in the spotlight kind of language, stuff like that. But let's get to the details that AMLO was presenting to Biden, because it's pretty good. So he went on a long speech about FDR, outlining a plan. Sorry, here we go. Lopez Obrador urged Biden to follow the bold example set by FDR, whose portrait hangs in the Oval Office and loomed over the shoulders of the two leaders as they spoke.
You know, honestly, sorry to cut you off there, but that just reminds me, like, Trump put Andrew Jackson on the wall and he fucking lived up to that shit.
Yeah, that's
Biden
true.
Putting FDR on the wall is embarrassing at this point.
I totally agree. So he pointed out to the positives in American history that Biden should be following on. He had this great dig. I don't know if you've seen this map, but he says, outlining a plan for greater cooperation and trade, the Mexican president informed Biden that he was allowing Americans to cross the border to purchase gasoline in his country, noting that it's currently $1 cheaper per gallon, jabbing at the political wound that is Biden's greatest liability. It was a familiar display to those who follow Mexico. Nearly every morning in Mexico, Lopez Obrador delivers a speech on television and takes a handful of questions from reporters. The session lasts for hours. Biden, once Lopez Obrador finished, reminded him that America's economy is the fastest growing in the world, while showing no umbrage and restating his respect for Mexico and its leader. The thrust of what you're saying, I agree with. We need to work closer together. Hours after the meeting ended, both countries announced in a joint statement that Mexico had to spend $1.5 billion on border infrastructure between 22 and 24, allowing the White House to glow on Twitter. Trump, in his 4 years, couldn't finish the border wall, let alone get Mexico to pay for it. Sort of shows you the mindset of the Biden administration. But good on AMLO for showing up there and coming up. AMLO also spent time to speak to Mexican immigrant workers in Washington, D.C., which I also found to be quite moving as well.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, I think we should get into it. How should we go about this, Matt? Should we introduce the subject to folks who might not know all the details? Because I think we don't want to make the assumption that everybody knows everything. You're a bit in this story, so would you prefer if I tell or would you like to?
You go and I'll be the color commentary.
Okay. So there is an election ongoing in New York State, and it's something that we have praised a lot, has been the DSA's plan, instead of, you know, just sort of pitching candidates as individuals, to run what they're calling the social slate. It's been a really inspiring strategy, and it's hopefully going to be successful. And again, you know, doing this kind of politics that we're talking about, it's like building out from just like politics being something, an individual endeavor, one both you as a voter, but also for politicians just sort of being you know, atomized individuals instead of firmly standing in a movement. It's something we've been advocating for a lot on this program, is that if we want to be serious about our politics, we need to be moving from a politics that's very much focused on individuals solely, and rather as a movement as a whole. And particularly, it's important when in, you know, certain areas like New York, using Democratic Party ballot access is really crucial, right? Pointing out that we have a very different kind of politics and vision for the future than the Democratic Party, right? So running as a slate creates that kind of opportunity for DSA candidates and the socialist movement to be able to define itself. And it's looking pretty good for most of the candidates in this election so far. But we're going to talk about one specific one because it's been a little close to home, and I think there's some things that we need to say about it. In New York District 59, correct? Kristen Gonzalez, who is a DSA-endorsed candidate, also endorsed by AOC and a lot of other left organizations, has been planning and doing the groundwork for a very long time to set herself up for victory in this district. A little while ago, the new districts were released and that district map shifted a little bit, but it still represents the core of the district that she was originally planning to run on. It's a district that she has deep roots in, community support, and also, crucially, DSA, the DSA cadre, which, remember, is not just, you know, for people who aren't in the DSA, for people who aren't familiar with this. One of the things that I think some people get confused about when they hear the word DSA endorsed is it's not a passive endorsement, or paper endorsement is the technical term for it. And what do I mean by that? A paper endorsement is where you say, we endorse this candidate, go vote for him. What DSA does is an active endorsement, meaning that the DSA actually devotes its resources, both money, but that's limited. Most importantly, the massive membership that they have, particularly in New York, into doing the on-the-ground canvassing work and creating an electoral operation. And that's twofold. That's important for a few different reasons, right? One, because it prevents us from getting into this position where we're endorsing people who don't really align with us, right? Becoming a kind of passive organization, like, for example, like Working Families Party, which endorses a lot of different candidates, and all of them are not necessarily in with him. Like, we didn't want DSA to be a pressure group. DSA needs to be an organized mass of workers and socialists. So having the active component is really important. Two, it's that kind of the way that they engage in politics is also important, because it means DSA members are going and knocking on doors and having those vital conversations with members of the community. It gives us presence in the community. It gives us knowledge about the communities, and it gives us face time with people to explain our perspective on politics. And when you're able to do it with somebody like Gonzalez or these other members of the social slate, it's especially important because we were really able to define what it is that we're trying to do. In that case, for New Yorkers who are facing, you know, incredible amounts of pressure from rising rents, from the failure of the state and local government to provide for them, to rising costs of living, right? This is a really important operation. Anyway, so all's well and good. And then Nomiki reaches out to Majority Report and goes on Majority Report and announces that she is going to be running for Senate.
Yeah. So basically, this is that's how I heard about this. And like you said, mentioned earlier, there was a redistricting, new districts came out. And so when I, as a producer of the Majority Report, had heard that, instead of just a normal Nomiki, she appeared on the show Tuesdays during the second half of the show, comment in the capacity of, you know, state and local politics, as somebody who is involved in New York as well as other localities' politics. And so she announced that afternoon. And it wasn't until the chat started going that I was aware of, oh, that is that there actually was a candidate in that. That mm-hmm. wasn't a new district that it was invented out of nowhere. That is not spoken for by DSA. There's a candidate mm-hmm. there that, and not only is it a DSA candidate, it's one that's already endorsed by like AOC, as you mentioned,
and the organization.
And I felt that was I'll say for the first time that information wasn't forthcoming to me, at least as a producer of that show. It wasn't, I know that, I can say just I want to speak for her on how she felt about it, but I knew that Emma Vigeland was solicited for an endorsement, and she did not know that there was that conflict. And so the next day, Emma and I were on the show as a Thursday Sam was out, but, you know, said that we endorse Kirsten. Because for this reason, it's, I mean, a few things come into it. One, it's just DSA, and I support DSA candidates. You know, if there's a even more radical, but a party-based organization, you know, focused candidate, movement-oriented candidate, then I'd be interested in that. But if it's just other candidates saying, and, you know, I felt like the rationales that I heard coming from an Amiki were ones that I don't agree with. I think it's not just she wants to run just because it's fun to have as many candidates in a democracy. I think she has a problem with DSA. Mm-hmm. I think you see that in the comments to her, to these things. You mentioned the WFP. There's a theory by Nomiki's fans that the WFP has taken over DSA. Now, these are the sorts of conspiracy theories that someone paranoid like myself likes to entertain. But that needs to come from, again, who are you, though?
Mm-hmm. Where are these receipts?
Exactly.
Can I just say, you know, it's been a bit since I've been in those like New York DSA circles, but when I was there, like Working Families Party was like a bad word. Like it was like a term of derision.
I don't like, you know, the Working
Families
Party.
It was something that was always sort of defined against, saying we don't want to become something like the Working Families Party. So like that kind of criticism, I don't know, is one suspect to me. And also, I mean, you know, if true, which it's not, I'm just going to say that flat out, you know, would mean that there has been a very extensive coup of many, many of the people who are good friends of mine to this day, people who I stay in contact with, who have completely changed their commitments and their political positions. And can I just say one thing really quick about like the New York DSA? I mean, like, this is an organization that has had tremendous success over the past few years and has really expanded. I remember when we had Julia Salazar on the program, and her victory in New York State Senate was a huge victory for DSA. And now we're in a situation where we're talking about a slate. And even in between then, Julia Salazar has been met with more DSA members in the Senate, right? Like, it's been a growing and successful movement, charting its own path, and it's viable, and it's not some kind of decrepit organization, right? This is something that is growing significantly right now, and is something that if you're on the left, I think that you should be wanting to support and see more of, and seeing that thrive.
Yeah, and so my posture was not to comment super closely on this case, and just sort of accept, you know, okay, fine, we want to play this, let's see how this experiment goes. In the back of your mind, though, there is something to be said for what anybody would say about, say, a Green Party candidate jumping in a close race, if they're going to play spoiler for the establishment. That's something you really have to worry about. And Crowley's daughter, who AOC, what was his name? John Crowley? I forget what the guy's first name was.
Joe
Crowley is running in this race, and his daughter. So it makes you think, like, okay, is there enough room? And if there isn't enough room, why should I personally, you know, want somebody who's not affiliated with like the DSA or whatever, who seems to be some sort of freelancing? So that's where it stood until I'm just narrating my involvement here.
Mm-hmm.
I commented that I was donating to Kristen. And then last week, I believe it was, Josh Fox tweets out a tweet that says, you vote for the last authentic New Yorker candidate, something to that effect. Is that close enough summation of what that tweet was?
I mean, just like to get the crux of it, effectively the implication, and it was the clear implication in the wording, was that Nomiki is the candidate who is actually from New York.
Which is like, to me, There's all sorts of issues with that line of argumentation. One, just from a personal credibility standpoint, Nomiki's quoted saying Tucson is the only home I ever know, or something to that effect when she was running out there. Like,
for Congress.
So like, why are we making this the issue? Even if we remove any sort of like uncharitable, but perhaps accurate, I don't know what you think, David, but the thing about the dog whistling, like, I think it's weird to say you're not,
and that kind of nativism is also has a nasty bent to it too.
It does.
And also, I might feel a little bit more free to speak about this, and I'm just going to say right now, I commend both you and Emma for being so forthright on this, because I know it's you know, a little personally awkward. I know Nomiki, so it's a little awkward for me too, which is why I've tried not to cannonball into it, other than, you know, retweeting and you know, making it clear that who I support in that race. But Nomiki's not from New York City either. And Gonzalez is, right? She's from New York State. That's not disqualifying. But the fact is that these are people who are close to your campaign as certain, like, whatever. You don't want to act like, oh, this person's not like an official campaign position. These are folks that you're speaking with. Yep. You know, like, part of that campaign is the fact that she's in progressive media in New York City. And yeah.
Let me comment on that. That's just Josh Fox going off on one sort of thing. That'd be a lot easier for me to believe if that wasn't another one of the justifications that Nomiki said for running the race, is that she's more authentic to the district than Gonzalez is. Like, that's what I heard. And like, that she can believe that. I think it seems weird, like, to go there, like, right when you were born in Buffalo. I don't know why that's brought up. And that's the main question, is you want to run this for democracy. I'm getting a little bit heated, but this is where we're at now. Mm-hmm. Is not only that, the Josh Fox thing, but Gonzalez tweets out, and maybe this is just somebody tweeting stuff out ahead of a fundraising deadline, but Kristen Gonzalez says a number of times, my opponent doesn't name Nomiki by name, but a number of times my opponent has said, welcome to Astoria. To me, and I guess the campaign is saying that's just something we say to everybody, blah blah blah, like that.
okay
sure. I think it's a little bit weird when one of it's on the heels of this authentic New Yorker, you know, who's this Gonzalez person. I and all of this this all happens. And now today we have a tweet from Nomiki, I assume in response to this, being called out for saying, you know, welcome to Astoria, not even by name, but just say my opponent, really a call for civility. Nomiki returns with her own call for civility, which is, your actions have consequences. Your tactics against us have encouraged supporters of yours to threaten, harass, physically and physically intimidate me. A lot of accusations there. Our team and supporters, we don't feel safe, and it's got to end now. Nobody should be afraid to run, speak out, or campaign. And you know who agreed with that? Dave, I don't know if you saw this. Did you see this? Elizabeth Crowley for State Senate. I stand with Nomiki Cons and pledged to a clean campaign. Well, nice. She's pledged to fix your fucking typos first. No campaign or candidate should encourage this behavior. There's absolutely zero that Kirsten is encouraging any sort of intimidation.
I know.
I'm sorry.
Like, we're being like very calm about this, but like, that is a huge accusation that, you know, she is inspiring people to go out and enact intimidation and violence. That's a serious charge. And nothing that has been delivered since then has come close to those kind of accusations. And even if, which it, by the way, it hasn't, this is not me like, you know, down, like, this is not me, making excuses like in a preliminary sense. This is me just saying, like, also, like, there are two claims here, right? One, that they are being threatened and intimidated and attacked. And two, that Gonzalez is involved in that, right? And you have to prove both of those things, which they have not done. And those are huge claims to just throw out in an election like this. And I mean, what is this bizarre united front now between the supposed progressive and Crowley, a name that everybody knows at this point what that's associated with, like the utmost rot of the Democratic Party? And this is in a, you know, in a New York Senate primary. And I think that it shows some very worrying tendencies of a certain kind of political persuasion to be willing to cozy up with the center against the socialist left.
Yeah, this is spin. This is the cynical side of politics. They got busted on this nativist bullshit, and so they decided to go on the attack. And I will just say another thing is a constant complaint from Nomiki about bots and about this harassment campaign is not new. It's a strategy she's gone to often. Mm-hmm. And it first went up when I had my first public disagreement with Nomiki over her... What started with her saying Congress should investigate the online left because we can't trust the gray zone, basically, was the summary of this. We should get Jamie Raskin involved, who recently said, and maybe it wasn't Jamie Raskin she had in mind, but I'll just say, like, the type of people who would probably be heading up this investigation, Jamie Raskin.
We can't wait for Holly, our good friend Holly, to be investigating, people like that. Look, and, like, we've had, like, very public disagreements with the gray zone, but, like, this is a position that I've been committed to for a long time, that these kind of claims about interference in the elections, that, you know, the Russians are behind it, or like foreign money and this stuff, can be very, very dangerous. And I speak from personal experience, because when that proper not stuff happened a while ago, I was just a young journalist writing pieces for a couple bucks for a little paper called Counterpunch, and people might know it. And proper not listed us all as people who were paid Russian agents. Complete bullshit. And that's dangerous when you realize the climate of today. And it's also extremely dangerous when you remember the climate of this country historically, right? It's a really, really dangerous game to play. So it's like, yeah, you know, like, screw people like Jimmy Dore. You know, I think Blumenthal is completely off of his rocker, right? But I do not want Congress to be getting involved in deciding what the truth is, especially when you know what constitutes truth for these people, the willingness that that body has had to lie to the American public, the willingness that the Biden administration has showed to persecute and torture journalists, as they are trying to do with Assange right now, or certainly whistleblowers in the society, right? That's a really, really dangerous game to play. Anyway.
Yeah, no, I mean, and that's the thing. So she tweeted that out. A lot of people had an issue with it, not just, you know, Max Blumenthal, but you, Ben Burgess, folks that actually tried to, like, you know, argue, but in, like, not, you know, calling her whatever. And the response was, you know, I talk about, like, bots or, like, nasty replies. It was complete McCarthyite centrists, or, I mean, I don't know what you want to call them, centrists, but these were folks who were, I mean, one guy, and what pissed me off and what eventually made me, I was on fucking vacation. I was in Madrid at this time. But some guy said he's just reply to Nomiki's tweet, which was like, hey, this is actually super concerning that you're saying this. A guy, some whack job, said, David's just concerned his rubles are going to dry up. Nomiki liked that tweet. She never denied liking the tweet. I called her on liking the tweet and said, what's the deal here? And she said, oh, there's a harassment campaign against me and bots. And guess what? If you can't handle that when you're just opining, you shouldn't run for office either. Like, the bots have snowed you. And I like that's the problem, and why I feel like speaking out a little bit more about this is because of the corrosive effect she's having on the people that trust her. And you hate to see it. That she's turning them against the DSA as if they're like some literally calling them anti-democratic along with fucking what's her name over here. Like, they're doing bot campaigns. Like, they're, I don't know. Like, I don't know what else. Like, are they banning operatives? Like, this stuff is, this is bad, bad political education. And if anything, and I hope Gonzalez wins.
And, like, this hasn't been a campaign that has really been moving the dial on these issues. You know, I suggest people check out Owen Higgins. Has hosted debates between Gonzalez's campaign manager and Nomiki's manager, Walker Bragman. And listen to that discussion. And I think you'll feel very, very clearly, as I do, that there is really no reason for Nomiki to be in this race. Other, like, at least the reasoning is beyond me. It certainly doesn't feel like it's about speaking up for people or, most importantly, working people. There's a lot of talk about small businesses.
There are implications
that Gonzalez doesn't care about COVID-19, which is absurd. Right.
I was going to say, for a while it was the left isn't taking COVID serious enough, which fundamentally, like, I have some, I'm at least welcoming that into a debate if it's confined there. But I also think it was it is cynical. And yeah, it's just to find an issue.
I mean, if we're doing this, there's a couple other things I want to note. I think that some of the campaign material has been a little disingenuous. There was one of the early ads that was put out, you know, social media ads, took people like Chris Smalls and Steve Donziger thanking her when they were guests on her podcast, which, by the way, is like what you do. I'm just, you know, for people who aren't in this industry, it's like every show I go on, I thank them. And I'm not saying it's not sincere, but I'm just saying, like, that just comes with the territory. And using now, that in a campaign makes it seem like Chris Smalls and Don Ziger are lining up with the campaign instead of saying, thank you for having me on your podcast, which I thought you. To be yes. Not good.
Yeah, that's bad.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely more to say. I know I'm not, I hope we're not coming off as too tedious or petty, but it's just like, I think it's worthwhile for us to come clean and be explicit about this because, you know, you have a closer relationship with her through work than I do, but like people associate us with this. And I've found this campaign to be pretty despicable through and through so far. I think the accusations are mean-spirited. I think coming in at first with the question whether or not this person's a New Yorker or not, and then this most recent one, I think is pretty egregious, especially when you remember that this is an election right now where you are up against like an extremely dangerous austerity candidate here. And I don't see the plus side. And for me, I mean, just put my politics on the table, which I think everybody knows by now. Like, I'm a socialist, and I think this also does show, you know, hopefully this is a personal crack in the sense that, like, what this represents is going to be less of a trend in the future. But it does show that there is a big difference between a progressive and a socialist on these things, explicitly on the question of some kind of form of left unity and trying to make sure that we have people who have a plan to win. If you listen to that conversation between Nomiki's campaign manager and Gonzalez's campaign manager, one thing that you will hear time and time again from Gonzalez's side is we have a plan to implement policy, which is something we just talk about on the show a lot, right? Where it's like, it's all well and good even to have like a nice policy proposal, right? But there's a big difference between aspiration and action. And I see the action side very, very much missing from the Nomiki side because the DSA argument is clear. We have a block. We are building a block. And if you elect this block, we will be able to do things that we can't do as an individual. Right. And I know Nomiki says, well, why do you think, you know, that you're saying they won't want to work with me if I get elected? You're one. You've made it very clear you're not a part of that movement. Why should we as the left trust that you have a commitment to follow through on all these other things that the DSA social, you know, slate is running on? There's no reason to believe that right now. You know, so of course, if she wins, I'm sure, you know, there'll be times when everybody's voting together. But that's not a cohesive block. That's not a cohesive plan for action in a state that desperately, desperately needs it. And most importantly, actually has a horizon right now that is achievable to improve the life of people in the largest city in this country, right? This is like serious stuff. So obviously there's the personal stuff. There's the kind of gossipy side to it. But the reason I think we're both so hot and bothered about it is like, this is not like, oh, somebody said something mean, you know, to somebody that we like. You know, I see that all the time. And I try to take a Michael approach to these things and sit out of like Twitter flame wars for the most part. I'm not always perfect on that. But certainly on the show, we don't try to get into that. But the reason that we care about this is because this has very serious stakes. And two, we're also personally implicated in a way in this. And it's worthwhile to be making it very clear you know, that we don't support this kind of this kind of action.
No, but yeah, particularly when the announcement was on the majority report.
Which, so, I mean, is there anything else that you wanted to note here? Gonzalez is fundraising like crazy, and is continuing to go from strength to strength. So it's a good time as any to find a way to donate and get involved in that campaign if you're in the area.
Yeah, and super disappointing to see a campaign like I followed Walker Bragman for a long time too, and it looks like to me, it has all the appearances of a anti-left campaign.
It is an anti-left campaign. Frankly, that's what it is. And I think Nomiki should drop out.
Me too. Yes.
And I will say, I don't know if we're going to do more on this in the future. I'd prefer not to. There are other things that I have that I think I'm going to hold close to my chest. But this is not the first time Nomiki has run for office and has alienated people that are close to her because of her actions. I don't want to have to tell those stories. So I hope that this is the end of this chapter.
Agreed.
All right. Sorry. Matt, you muted yourself.
Yeah, sorry.
Matt just told it.
I just blurted it out, but no.
I mean, I'm glad that we have a movement, frankly. It gives me a lot of happiness to know that, you know, I think the outrage and the frustration is shared by many, many people right now. And I just hope, because, you know, like, I know Nomiki and I like her. And, like, I just hope that she could sort of see the error here and try to rectify it instead of continuing down this scorched earth path, which is going to be very damaging for her.
I saw Forrest, our former editor's reply, saying, "Nomiki, don't do this."
Yeah.
Yeah. Please. I mean, I think, you know, don't give her ammunition, because that's what her and her campaign seem to be looking for now is the bots that are super rude and threatening about them. And look, I imagine that there probably have been a few people that have said things that are crossed the line, and that should not happen. I imagine it's also happened to Kristen Gonzalez. Actually, I've heard it from supporters of Nomiki. The show of Majority Report extremely heatedly. There's a Sam read an email out, and like, only it was like, bro, chill. Right? Like, so yes, there's heat.
You know, can I say one thing about this? Because like, some of the talking points that we get are, you know, from some of the people who are mad at us for saying stuff in support of Gonzalez, are like, well, don't you care about democracy? You know, yes, everybody has the ability and the right to run for office. The question here is, do you see yourself as a part of a movement that is fighting for Medicare for all, that is fighting for rent control, that is fighting to kick the developers out of that state and that community, right? Trying to find a kind of politics that works for working class people. Do you consider yourself a member of that movement? And that means participating in that movement in the way that is the most helpful to that movement. And what Nomiki is doing right now is not helpful. So yeah, she has the right. The criticism that we have of her is not because she doesn't have the right to run for office. It's because we say, I thought you were on the left. I thought that you were on the side of this kind of politics, and you're making it very, very clear right now in running in opposition to this that you're standing against it. So is it surprising that all the other people who are in that movement are saying, hey, this is fucked up? I don't know why that is confusing to people, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, especially look at the date that we're saying this. It's July 13th. How long has she been in the race? We gave all that time, and it took this, which is, look, it's a she said from the campaigns. And I guess, I mean, Nomiki hasn't denied the Welcome to the Story stuff. They just counterattack. And I think it's a cynical counterattack. And they think that Gonzalez is being cynical ones. And again, that just speaks to, what's the message of this campaign? Mm-hmm. The left is bad.
Yeah. It's not good. But yeah, so we'll take some voicemails and questions. I'm not seeing anything in the Discord. I don't know if that's an issue. I will also take them if you're in the YouTube, you know, just you can throw in the chat too and we'll read those as well. But do we have any voicemails queued up or?
Yeah. First voicemail here. I'm not sure who this is from.
Howdy. This is Mauve from Twitch, where I'm a Prime subscriber because the state pays educators in Amazon gift cards instead of money. But I am also from Utah, and I wanted to talk about the Great Salt Lake and I guess the impending, or I guess already going climate apocalypse that's happening. But I think people are kind of already familiar with kind of Lake Mead and the ongoing Southwest water wars, right, where there's kind of a fight over what water goes where. But this thing with the Salt Lake is kind of, I would say, even more dire in how it's going to affect the air quality. Basically, Salt Lake and Denver already have what I would consider to be the worst air quality in the world. last year, there was a week where if you went outside, it was basically like having a cold in terms of how it would affect your respiratory system, right? A lot of people weren't sure if it was just the air quality or the, if they had COVID, I guess. But basically, I've become a little bit doomer-pilled after kind of seeing the New York Times article about the Great Salt Lake. I feel like the response from a lot of liberals is that basically Utahns and Mormons deserve it for, you know, being descended from polygamists and, you know, for praying for more water, I guess. But to me, I feel like there's a little bit of like Spider-Man pointing meme where the Republicans and Governor Cox, right, their only real policy is to just pray for more water, hope for a miracle. I guess there's the plan to try to bring ocean water into the Salt Lake, which good luck, I guess. But the liberal policy is just to ask individuals to use less water, which to me is about as effective as praying for more water. So I feel like there's just a complete empty void where anyone making any kind of policy would be. We did have one senator who wanted to ban water-intensive agriculture, which is what uses the vast majority of the water here, 85%. But he was he lost his primary after the real estate-owned city council endorsed his opponent. And the state also just isn't running a Democratic senator, so I don't hear any actual solution. And I feel like the federal government, which maybe should step in to save millions of people from being poisoned by arsenic when it comes into the air and then stays here because the mountains cause an inversion, should, you know, they aren't really doing anything either. So I guess I'm just not really sure what to do in terms of, you know, the activists here aren't even really talking about it either. It's all just save the lake. Like, no one has an actual plan. But one thing that I just did want to throw out there, which I didn't see in the New York Times article, is that the arsenic did not just appear in the lake. It actually was leaked in there by Rio Tinto Copper, which is a $100 billion company. So, yeah, things are bad. But good news, the tourists might actually believe me when I tell them that the lake is disgusting and not to go there. All right. Thanks, y'all.
I appreciate the call. I think that that Spider-Man point was good, that like liberals getting worked up about religious people praying for a solution to this who also think
yes,
you just get the right price is the same kind of mentality, frankly.
That is very funny.
I appreciate the call. We have one from the chat, I believe. From our good friend in Australia, MDR, one of our many Australian friends. Some bit of good news, our Socialist Alliance comrade and human rights activist, Stephen Langford, has been acquitted of the charge, malicious damage to a statue in Hyde Park. Well, I'm really happy to hear that. I don't know if people recall, but one of their friends got wrangled up in some kind of Extinction Rebellion kind of style action and was facing the full weight of the state. And they were very worried about, you know, facing a pretty extreme punishment for their action. So I'm happy to hear that, friend. Yeah, they have a follow-up. He was charged 2 years ago What he did was paste the paper with some writings on it on the statue of Governor Lachlan Markery in Sydney's Hyde Park.
Jesus.
Or somebody else. The paper, was this somebody else? The paper read, all Aborigines from Sydney onwards are to be made prisoners of war, and if they resist, they are to be shot and their bodies hung from trees in the most conspicuous place near where they fall, as to strike fear into the hearts of the surviving natives. Words of Lachlan Markery led to the 1816 Appine Massacre. Yeah, I mean,
good.
I think bringing those things to light is a painful but worthwhile endeavor.
Yeah. We've got a few more. I'm going to play them. We got a number of calls that came in, actually, so I'm going to play these a little bit at a 1.3 speed so we can try to get through all of them.
Hey, Dave and Matt. This is Jack calling from Montclair, New Jersey. So I'm actually planning to attend my first in-person North Jersey DSA event soon, and I wanted to thank you guys for the push on that. Next thing is, I have a friend who is a long-term vet tech, and her experience there has reminded me of just how nasty that sort of business can be to their employees. So I wanted to ask you and any of the listeners, is there anything going on with unionization of veterinary workers? I haven't come up with anything yet. And then I wanted to thank Kowalski for my new favorite farewell blessing, and wish you guys the good blessings of the spirit of John Brown. I've been sharing that one with all my friends, and I love it. All right, have a great night.
Hell yeah, friend. I don't know any veterinary worker unionization, but just as an every worker deserves a union, and it'd be a good thing for them to get it. I can't imagine that industry is particularly pleasant to work in, in the sense of working conditions and expectations, especially from any kind of like tech rollers, things like that.
Yeah. Here's the next one.
Hey, Matt and David, this is Michael from Salt Lake City. Got two things for you. One for you, David, since you are a connoisseur of the hustle and grinding Instagram post. What is your favorite post you've come across that hasn't made sense? For example, my favorite one, I saw some account, and it was like a 40-second clip of the actress Anne Hathaway talking about how she rips the bottom off of a cupcake to make it and puts it on top, so it's like a cupcake sandwich, and that was like a thing that impressed people at a party. I don't get how that has to do with hustling and grinding, but there it was. Secondly, more importantly, Salt Lake DSA, we're having a day in the park this Saturday to celebrate the recent union win of our Cottonwood Heights Starbucks. And so, yeah, we're going to be hanging out with one of their union organizers who I've been in touch with throughout the whole process and just having fun in the park, taking a page out of Chris Small's handbook and just eating, having some fun. So, yeah, anyone in Utah wants to come by, check out the Salt Lake City DSA Instagram account with all the information. Thanks. Bye.
Hell yeah, man. Bread and roses, right? Like, that's the ethos. I can't pronounce his last name, Gary Vaduchik or something like that. He's one of the big ones. Y'all have seen him if you watch any of that stuff. He was going, I saw one and I really wish I found, I like recorded it because I try to find it later and I couldn't. But there was one of him saying how he doesn't spit gum out. He's never spit gum out because he thinks that the time that it takes for him to spit it out and throw it away is too much of a waste of his time, so he just swallows his
No,
gum.
That checks out, yeah.
Yeah. Probably explains a lot more.
Yeah. I always see the fucking flat earth ones.
Oh, like, dude, I need to get on yours, man. Mine are really getting bad.
It's like, this is what the earth could actually, this is what the map of the flat earth actually is. It's like, that's even more hard to believe than it's a globe, guys. Like,
dude, yeah. Have you ever watched the flat earth documentary on Netflix?
No,
dude, that was like one of the best posts, because sometimes we come back from those shows Tuesday night, at least for me, I'd be a little wired. It's hard for me to get to bed. Smoked a little weed and watched it. It's like, I'll find the name of it. It's pretty good. Characters in the movement are fascinating.
The phenomenon isn't that interesting to me, I gotta say. Like, certain matters of fact can be a coin flip, and they can come up in people 99% out of 100, but for whatever reason, people are going to be idiosyncratic about things and just go the other way, especially when you have like distrust of government and stuff like that. So like, to me, I almost think like the freak out over flat earthers is like, as like, oh, these people are thinking the wrong thing. It's like, that's a very harmless wrong thing to think in the annals of wrong things. Like, we had people who thought we should bring Jim Crow back, and I mean, we still have those people, but like, right, like, there's certain types of ideas that are more concerning to me than like people being wrong about the shape of the earth. But
so I know we got a lot of these. I'm just keeping us up with the chats too, because they're quick. Strom McCallum says, how about the idea of starting a Southern Marxist publication, organizing a Southern Marxist convention? I'll just say there are some plans in the work, ooh, in the works, Jesus Christ, on that. But, and I would love to, you know, explore that too, and definitely would want you to contribute to that. Our friend Technomancer says, I may have missed it, but where do I get a hat like Dave's? Coming soon. Coming soon.
This is pre-release.
Yeah, pre-release.
Here's our next IM.
Hi, David and Matt. This is Dylan from Australia. Just wanted to say, gosh, what a fantastic show today, talking obviously about the military-industrial complex and how it preys upon the working class, but also, David, letting us know, you know, what a progressive place parts of Texas are. You know, obviously a lot of people see they have that very negative opinions of Texas, but it's nice to know that there are these progressive parts of it with great culture. And boy, was he looking handsome tonight, I think. I think we can agree. Matt, 100%, I think you'd agree. How good he looks with that beard, as opposed to you with that 1970s porn mustache that you love to sport so much. Anyways, keep up the good work. David, you are much like Jesus, Christ-like. And yeah, take care.
I will send you the comic book, buddy. You don't got to keep buttering me up so much. I appreciate
that. Oh, okay. There's an alternative motive for that. I understand. Okay. Interesting. yeah, I mean, Dave, you look fine today. gosh, we've got a bunch. I'm gonna make sure I don't skip any.
Nice. I mean, yeah.
Here we are. Oh, Kowalski. Good. I want to hear if he has any take on this organic stuff.
Hey guys, it is Kowalski from Nebraska. Now, I'm sure many people are curious with the whole Sri Lanka crisis and food situation, but I have bad news. This is likely the first of many dominoes to fall. Given the way the growing season is progressing and how things have been for the last few months globally, I would not be shocked if we started seeing a lot of authoritarian crackdowns across the Middle East, probably bigger countries like China and the United States, for whatever reasons we would have to want to bully grain shipments to certain areas, will likely take place. I would just say things are probably going to get pretty turbulent come August and September. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of curious what your guys' thoughts are, considering it was food crisis that basically triggered the Arab Spring, or was one of the biggest factors for it. So if we see an Arab Spring-like event occur just before the elections, do you think that will help the Democrats, hurt them? Personally, I think it's going to do a lot of positives for the Brazilian election, but that's just me. Also, not to end on a complete downer, I was talking with some friends of mine, and we think we figured out how to get the price of gasoline below $2 a barrel. Now, this is real John Brown energy, but all we have to do is get all the oil CEOs into one room and most of their board, and we eat half of them in front of the other half. We literally eat the rich. I'm pretty sure they'll give in to our demands. All right, you guys have a good one. And if you're going on vacation, Matt, enjoy.
Thank you, Kowalski.
Always good hearing from you.
Ominous stuff. Yeah. I don't have a forecast. I don't feel up to that. Oh, but
I mean, I thought he was kidding.
Yeah. but
no, I mean, it's bad, and it's like a good reason not to start fucking around with like bad agriculture policy at a time when it's already tough enough. Yeah.
That stuff's brutal.
Hey guys, it's Real Snuffy. Just a quick thought tonight. I guess I'm hearing a lot of people try throwing out analogies to explain the utterly bizarre and, I mean, predictable, but still, like, just stunningly strange behavior of the Democrats in response to the Roe decision and everything else that they've been doing to facilitate the Republicans at every turn. So like I said, I can hear a lot of tortured analogies, and just wanted to throw out my personal one. So my go-to analogy to explain the relationship between the Democrats and the Republican Party is that imagine that we're living in during a zombie apocalypse. And the Republicans are they are the family member that's a zombie, and the Democrats are the deranged family member that's kind of like partially chained up the Republicans in their house, and they trick other survivors into coming into the house so that they can feed them to their loved ones who of course they think they'll just be fine, they're totally going to recover, they're going to get better soon, and meanwhile obviously this goes as expected. So anyway, like I said, that's my analogy, and hope everyone's have a good night.
Bye. Been watching The Walking Dead?
I started watching a show called Black Summer on Hulu or Netflix. Don't watch that shit, man. It sucks.
It's a bad show?
It's any zombie survival stuff can be compelling for a little bit, but ultimately there's just these really long-ass scenes of like either horrible or like slightly horrible things happening where you're looking at your watch and you're like, are you just padding out 10 episodes right now? Like, really? Do we not have enough content? Like, maybe you should have made this 5-part series.
Dude, and it's like any kind of thing like that. It's like the initial mystery, like once they go on for a little while, it starts to wane. Cause like they all know that like the second that they start to explain things, you're going to start to lose interest. So they try to just drag you along. Yeah. I love like sci-fi and fantasy stuff, but like that's one of, as I've gotten older, it's like it actually makes it hard for me to watch a lot of shows because I start to feel it's like, oh, they're never going to have a satisfactory like answer to any of these questions.
Yes.
It's going to keep me going for 10 years.
This is why the best part of a horror movie is always like the first 45 minutes. And then once they start showing you the monster, it's like, okay, kind of done.
Not scary.
Another call here. Got a little short one.
Spencer in Utah here. Matt, we want to know the secret. Which national park are you visiting for your vacation? Love you, boys.
Yellowstone. I'm going to
it's
Yellowstone.
A big one.
Yeah. Ever heard of it?
I've never been on. Though, isn't this, I don't know.
I'm not sure. I don't quite think that. It looks a little bit too vertical for Yellowstone, but I might be a Philistine.
Yeah, you're probably right. Anyway. I should know what that is.
Got a couple more. This is one from our friend Dave from Jamaica.
Privet, comrades. I've donated the rubles in your account directly. Just kidding, guys. It's Dave. I will comment on the Nomiki stuff other than saying it's pretty disappointing, but also I don't know. I'll just say, you know what? I'm staying away from it. But the thing I wanted to call in on was and I think you guys talked about it, is that the whole Trump versus Elon thing. I really hope it gets bigger because for the folks that were Trump fans and Elon fans, I want to see the cognitive dissonance, how that's going to work out. But other than that, the other thing I really wanted to speak on is thank you. I'm such a mess today. Your views on utopianism, not in the sense of unrealistic stuff, but as a thing for people to aspire to, especially in times like now when people are down in the dumps. Not to get lost in fantasy and stuff like that, but, to give things people to strive for. You know what I mean? Because sometimes when you're in the dark times, you can't, you're just moving on from day to day and not really thinking that far ahead. So what is your, maybe it's a bit philosophy wise, but what is your guys' thought on utopianism in the left, especially in tough times?
Well, I mean, the Oscar Wilde quote is the best.
I forget what it is now. It's, but like it's been a while.
Any map without what is
right?
I'm fucking it up now too. Now
any
that
any map me. Without Utopia isn't worth following or something.
Yeah,
like that. Yeah.
And I think I generally agree with that. I mean, like for me, it's just like this is why I try to make the point over and over that like you know like socialism is a critical philosophy, but it's an optimistic one too, in the sense that like out of all this bad stuff, there is the seeds of a much, much better world. And like, you know, diving into that is exciting and I think could be very motivating. You know, utopianism like has like a bad connotation. And I think like the kind of Marxist criticism of like fanciful stuff, like, I mean, frankly, even like Oscar Wilde, as much as we were saying how great that quote is, like what Oscar Wilde imagined like the future should look like was just, you know, the kind of thing that a fancy lad sort of imagines the future yeah. will look like, you know, so it wasn't just like unpractical. It was sort of like you're leaving some people out of the equation in a way, but no, I mean, I think like that there is the optimism of like imagining a world. I mean, like I've always loved like even, you know, Marx's line on like, he very rarely wrote about like what communism would look like. But I always liked it, you know, it was like, heard like be a fish in the morning, herd cattle in the afternoon and write criticism after dinner without ever being a fisherman, a farmer or a critic. And it's not about those specific activities. It's actually that like you can engage in like different kinds of work and labor and activity
yeah.
Without having like your job necessarily define your entirety, which I've always found to be, you know, very motivating, along with the idea that like you're having your needs met and not having to, I mean, you know, I've gone up and down in income in my life many times. And it's like one thing that's always notable to me versus like what times when money is tight versus when, it's not, is like not getting stressed about the month changing. You get what I mean? Because it's like next month,
yeah.
there's another rent bill, there's all these things. And it's like, you know, you figure out how to do it that 1 month. And then it's like, okay, you're living for a week. And then you realize, fuck, I have this other big hurdle I have to cross.
Yep.
And like getting rid of that, like anxiety and constant pressure on yourself. It's like, it feels very utopian to me a lot of times.
But yeah.
There's no, more than that too.
Absolutely. I think you nailed it. Like combination of meaningful work, like to us, like your soul's perspective, whatever that is. And if not abundance, a lack of deprivation.
Yeah.
We got, I think, one more here.
Cool.
Hey there, Matt and David and patrons. This is Evan from Portland, and I just wanted to say love the show. And also wanted to point out that the Raising Cain that Trump speaks about is now the Associate Director for Military Affairs of the Central Intelligence Agency. So I think there might be some deep state going on. Thanks, guys. Keep it up.
Oh, short and sweet.
Oh, yeah, well, thank you so much for the call. That's, yeah. I'm trying to find it. K. Sully 22, right? 27. Does anyone want to help me buy a radio station in Nebraska? You know, if you're serious about that, I can't help you with it. But the guys at Valley Labor Report, what they've done, I think, is such an interesting model. You know, if that's something that you're serious about, like pursuing, you know, they found a way to get time on conservative talk radio because they have to sell spots in the morning. And they go on there and they talk about union and left politics on there, which I think is a great little awesome. Use of your time. And they might be able to talk to you a little bit about like the ins and outs of what that looked like.
Yeah, that's it's so awesome.
Let's see. We have, let me just pull that off the screen. I think we just have a couple of quick Discords. Appreciate everybody. And remember this weekend, Bronco March of Teach will be joining us for the Sunday show, which you get access to since you're patrons. Louis Anarchist says, wanted to know if you guys saw the article in Jackman about the Institute for Christian Socialism. We wrapped up our 6-month political education session, and we've just started a conservative context working group to find ways to bridge the gap with the sincerely faithful but conservative Christians.
Mm.
on issues of mutual economic interest and social justice without compromising our commitment to intersectionality and tolerance. Thanks for boosting. It's definitely changed my life for the better. I have that bookmark. I haven't read it yet, but I'm looking forward to it. And hey, congrats. That's exciting to see the movement there.
And yeah, shout out.
You're doing God's work, friend.
I was just going to say a shout out to our socialist Christians. You know, I feel like, you know, when I go on my rants of calling things like Adam and Eve fundamentalism or this and that, just know that I love you guys. You know, would love to go to Mass with you or whatever the thing's called.
Whatever the Protestants say.
Yeah, exactly. Whatever Protestants say. I'm not a Catholic.
It's funny. I really didn't know, other than Mexican Catholics, did not know many Catholics growing up. So I guess I knew a lot of Catholics.
All I knew was white Catholics. So.
Yeah, that was a weird thing in New York for me. I don't know. Haven't been exposed to that very often. Champagne Communist has a question for us on this. What does a healthy campaign battle between two leftists look like? Or should one always drop out for the greater good and support the other leftist who has a bigger chance of winning?
I don't think it even is the bigger chance of winning that. I mean, I think that's an argument. Yeah. Let's say that was true of Nomiki, but I think it's the one who has the most movement and organization support that's most compelling.
I mean, it would also be the party that I, you know, like there's, I'm sorry. I use the term leftist a lot. But I'm not a leftist. I'm a Marxist. I'm a socialist. And there is a difference. And
yeah,
it's very rare in our political arena right now where those differences sort of meet on a political campaign. I will say, frankly, in this context, I think it's like much less of an ideological battle, frankly. In that sense, I think there's a little bit of personal stuff going on. But I mean, like, let's imagine like a future where we have like progressive candidates versus socialists. No, I don't think that it's necessarily the case that the candidate with the smaller percentage needs to drop out. I think in maybe certain circumstances, maybe trying to build a kind of united front is worthwhile, like especially if like the opposition is like a fascist. But you know, I think like that kind of like stark moment is few and far between. I mean, I think that, like, I don't know. I mean, politics is about competing and winning, and I would want to be supporting my side and winning. I mean, I'm just putting my cards on the table.
Let me be clear. You know? Yeah. Let me be clear about what, like, the side is. Like, I made this point when I originally endorsed Gonzalez's Majority Report, which is that even if my buddy Chris threw his hat in the race, and there was also a DSA person that got in the race even after him, I would support the DSA candidate. I would hope if they're going to run it, and then I would hope that there was some spoiler effect and just hope that the best candidate wins. If Chris would have won, then I'd have felt okay about that, but I would have ultimately endorsed the DSA person. And if Chris would have been attacking the DSA person with basically Bernie bro style, toxic, corrosive, like, then I would have a problem with Chris.
And I was about to say, like, there's also like in that scenario, like, a potential where like that could be a clean campaign in the sense that like they're saying, here's my pitch, here's your pitch. And like, you know, that's fine. And like in the context that you're saying, I wouldn't have like personal animosity towards the opponent, the progressive opponent there. I also think it's important to remember that like, while there is a difference between progressives and socialists, like they're close on a lot of things. I mean, that's like a lot of this coalition has been built upon that like understanding. So it's not helpful to just sit there and like alienate and like attack them, and their supporters. And that's what's so shameful about what we're seeing in this race is that it almost immediately, became like this, and there's a reason for it, frankly.
Yeah. There's nothing else to it.
I don't know if this is a joke from our good friend in Australia, Umberto Ionian says, what is an ulterior motive? But is that referencing something that I'm not catching?
Or is that just putting the answer forward like Jeopardy question? I don't know.
Sorry.
If someone is wondering what an ulterior motive, it is a secondary motive that is not your explicit one. It's a concealed motive.
Evan says, Eugene, Oregon, home of the U of O Ducks, just passed greater renter protections thanks to their DSA.
Great job for doing those college towns. That's awesome.
It's smart. And again, it's like, that's how you can use power to make people's lives better and win things in the long term. I mean, it'll come out later, but I did a long podcast with our friend C. Derek Varn, and him and I do not see eye to eye. It was a friendly conversation, but we don't see eye to eye in the DSA. And like, that was one of the points that I was trying to make. Like, you know, I'm extremely critical of the Democratic Party, and I get sometimes frustrated when people act like DSA people like are ignorant of that tension. Yeah. You know, which is just like, I don't know. It's like, you should talk to people, isn't it? Because like, that's like a live wire debate constantly. But like, that is exactly the kind of politics that really works, because it's like, you have this opportunity here where you know, especially in the college town or a liberal town, where you could find ways to win. And I don't know how y'all won it, through ballot initiative or through, you know, pressuring elected representatives. But like, you know, that's the kind of thing that I was saying, like, one of the examples I said to see Derek Varn is like, with the victories that Austin DSA, for example, has been able to get, means that when people want to organize on something, they realize we need to call those folks, which only grows the power of the organization and the people who are either in it directly or sort of in it, you know, in an extended sense. And like, that's good for power building versus like having like the pure, you know, party, which doesn't run any candidates, but you put out a newspaper that 10 people read that has like the most eviscerating text about why Nancy Pelosi sucks, you know? I think like having that goal towards power and improving people's life is worthwhile.
I like to hear that happening in a college town. If you wanted to stop student loan inflation, do rent control in every college town and see the effect that has on it.
Evan says it was a pressure campaign. City council voted 6-2 for it. So hell yeah. Like, and that's also like, even more is something that's worthwhile remembering too, is that like, you can push people in power to do what we need them to do too. And they don't have to be dyed in the wool leftists or socialists or anything like that to get that to happen. Right. But that comes from organizing and having, you know, a very powerful, and smart, you know, tactics for winning. Anyway, that's it for questions. So this Sunday, we'll be hanging out with Bronco. Next week, hopefully, I'm going to try to get it done over the next 2 days. We'll have the website up and y'all be able to rock these hats around town as you're pressing your city council to put on renter protections. Mm-hmm. We'd love to see it. Until then, everybody, Matt, have a good time in Yellowstone.
I will. And yeah, we'll see you with Bronco.